We are in the book of Esther again here after taking a break last week. And Esther is the book that really gives rise to the Jewish holiday of Purim or Purim. Jewish leaders around the world during Purim or Purim read the book of Esther to excited crowds and synagogues. And adults, and especially kids, wait eagerly for the reading of chapter 3. And I'd like to invite you to open a Bible with me, if you would, to Esther chapter 3. The reason that they wait for this eagerly is because chapter 3, verse 1, introduces Haman, the villain of this account of the book of Esther. And each time his name is read in the reading of the book, it occurs some 53 times, each time it's read, the synagogue erupts into noise as horns blow, rattles shake, children shout, adults jeer, because the synagogue members are trying to drown out his name with their uproar, the wickedness of Haman. In the book of Esther, this villain, this archetypal enemy of the Jews, and his evil deeds are brought out in chapter 3, and in fact the whole book of Esther then focuses upon the response to Haman, beginning here in chapter 3. It's a central conflict of this book, and it really is a picture. Haman is a picture of what evil does in humanity. And again, I want to invite you to have a Bible open with me. We began looking at Esther chapter 3 2 weeks ago, and we looked at the first six verses. And you might remember there what had occurred. Haman was elevated to the position of second in command in Persia by King Xerxes himself. Now, these events actually occurred in Persia in about the year 480. Actually, King Xerxes ruled from 485 to 465 BC. And it was in the capital city of Susa where many of these events occurred. Susa is located in what today is modern-day Iran. There's a city there, but there is a large archaeological site also of vast ruins of ancient Susa. But since the Garden of Eden, evil has been at war with good in this world. And at times, as we look around, evil seems to hold sway. In fact, at times, righteousness seems to be on the ropes. There's evil all over. And that's one of these situations that we read about here in Esther chapter 3. In fact, Haman's pride brought on this evil here, and it's prevalent and strong in this world. And this morning, as we look at the last part of this chapter, what we want to know, or what we want to notice, is how evil grows and some various stages of its growth as it grows. And so I invite you again to have a Bible open with me. Beginning there in verse 7, we see evil entreated, how it looks for support. In verse 7, these words, "In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar," or Adar. Now, the year would have been about 474 B.C. The month of Nisan would have been the springtime. It was the first month of the Jewish year. Would have been comparable to March, April, right in that area of the spring that this would have been occurring. And they were casting lots. You remember that Mordecai, in the first six verses, we read about how Haman had been elevated to second in command, and he wanted everybody to bow down and give him reverence. And there was a Jew at the gate of the city that would not bow down to him, a guy by the name of Mordecai. And Haman found out about that, and he was furious. Everybody else did obeisance before him, but here this Jewish man, Mordecai, would not bow down and give him his honor. Haman was a puffed up, arrogant character. And he not only became furious with Mordecai, not only wanted to kill Mordecai, he wanted to kill all of Mordecai's people, the Jews. And in verse 7, we see how he began to carry that out. And he cast lots. In verse 7, that time, the 12th year of Xerxes, the first month, they cast the pur, the lot. Now, what is that? What does it mean? We don't know exactly. It might be something like throwing dice or throwing stones out there to see the arrangement they end up in. It may be drawing something. We think of drawing straws. But it was some form of a chance. And they would use this to decide various issues. In fact, it was common in the ancient world to use lots, or the pur, that's a Persian word, to find out the God's decision. And even the Jews use that, the casting of lots, at various times. Some of you are familiar in the Old Testament with the term the Urim and the Thummim for following God's will. And we don't know exactly when they used that, what prescribed when you use this and when you didn't use it, but it was used. In fact, Solomon in Proverbs 16 made this statement, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." And they recognize that God is sovereign and that if all else failed, we didn't know what to do, we could cast lots and we would trust that God would guide us. Well, Haman was casting lots. And what he was casting lots for was to find the perfect time to carry out his plan to kill Jews in the kingdom of Persia, which was massive. In fact, this massive kingdom, remember we mentioned it went all the way from India, all the way through modern Turkey, up to the edge of Greece, and then south, it went into Africa, North Africa, to what is today modern northern Sudan. It was a massive kingdom. And he wanted to know, we're going to kill all the Jews in the kingdom, what day is the best day to do it? Even though he didn't necessarily worship the God of the Jews, he was suspicious enough and had enough wisdom to realize there was something out there and we want to do it in line with our gods. And so he looked for the time frame. And what we read there in verse 7, he cast lots and they selected, the lot fell on the 12th month in the month of Adar. Now, this is interesting. The day that they're casting lots is the first month, the month of Nisan. The month that is chosen is the last month. They had to go through 11 months, come all the way around till the following February, March, and that's where the lot fell. And how they did that exactly, maybe they listed off the months and just then threw the dice or whatever they did, we don't know, and then they did it for the days. But the day that was chosen was the 12th month in the month of Adar, and actually we'll find out later it was on the 13th day of that month that it was chosen. So they had their time frame. But you notice something about Haman. His evil plans were now being put into action. His hatred for Mordecai had spread out to hate all Jews, and now it was taking the step to putting it into action. Let me just mention here, as we talk about evil this morning and the whole issue of evil, which is so common in our world, and we know it's in our own hearts also, that this is a key point. All of us have evil in our hearts. We have sin in our hearts, as Rich read here in the opening scriptures this morning from Romans 7. But there's a line that is crossed when you start to put evil into practice. When it's not only the inside, it's not only my hatred on the inside, but now I'm going to start to act out on it. And he crosses that line and he finds this day. And he plans his slaughter of the Jews. And in verse 8 we read about the prejudice. It goes on, he takes another step. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There's a certain people dispersed and scattered among all the peoples in the provinces of your kingdom whose customs are different from those of other people and who do not obey the king's laws. And it's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them." He's second in command and he realizes he can't carry out this genocide against the Jews without the approval of the king. And so he goes to the king. But notice in verse 8 how as he presents his case to the king, some of the tactics that he uses is he first of all presents the Jews in a very negative light. Notice he says they keep separate. Therefore the idea is they're not really part of us. They're untrustworthy. But the fact that people keep separate as a group isn't unusual. Your forefathers, my forefathers, before they came to this country, whether they're from Europe or wherever they were from, most of us probably have European ancestors, when they came to this country, they settled in pockets. That's one of the reasons that Wisconsin is so heavily German and Polish. That's one of the reasons why beer is big in Wisconsin, because it was big in the lands of our ancestors. It shouldn't be surprising that the Jews would be in pockets. When immigrants come into a situation, they tend to hang together. And in this situation, the Jews were captives there in Persia, taken captive earlier by the Babylonians. It shouldn't surprise us that they would settle together in a group. But Haman looks at that and says, they keep separate. Therefore, you know, we're suspicious of them. And then he goes on and says, they observe different customs. Well, that naturally sets them apart. But again, that's normal. Immigrants come to the United States and we bring our customs with us from our previous countries. That's normal. And the Jews brought their customs, but Haman says that makes them suspect. They're not Persian in their customs. then he makes the statement there in verse 8, they disobey the king's laws. They are lawbreakers. Therefore, they're automatically guilty. Now, he doesn't list what laws they've broken. In fact, he's making a vast generalization that isn't true. Generally, the Jews were very, very good citizens in the countries in which they lived in. They were very good businessmen. They were honest and upright. They followed the Jewish law. It is true that they would break the law of having to worship a pagan god, and they would refuse to be polytheistic. But they didn't break all the laws of Persia. But Haman's setting his case before the king. And so he says, they break the king's laws. And then in summary, notice what Haman does there in verse 8. He comes across like he is concerned for the king's best interest, not his own. He says that the final phrase there, it is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. The word tolerate means to cause them to rest. In other words, don't let these Jews just continue on as they are. It's not in your interest, king. And Haman is so deceptive. He's making his case before the king, and he's saying, it's not like I want to kill them. I don't have any reason to kill them. But for your interest, O king. This is the way evil works. In fact, it works this way in our hearts too. It lies. Not only to ourselves, but to others. And that's what Haman was doing. It was a series of truth, half-truth, and outright lies that he presented to the king. And notice something about verse 8. As he makes his case to King Xerxes, he omits specific details. He doesn't even tell Xerxes who they are. He doesn't say, these are the Jews. He doesn't state the group. Perhaps the king was not even curious enough to know. We don't read that the king even answered, asking who they were. He just trusted Haman. And Haman depersonalizes them. By the way, that is a good way. If you want to carry out evil on someone, don't get to know them. That was one of the characteristics of Hitler's Nazi Germany during World War II. In the concentration camps, they didn't name the people or go by their given names. They gave them numbers that they tattooed upon them. If you can make a person a number. And that's the way prejudice works. You see that Haman's picture of the Jews was very much prejudiced. And by the way, immigrants have dealt with that in every generation. When immigrants come in, we look at them, we say, they're separate from us. They don't meld in with us. They got their own customs. Certainly, they're not fitting in with us. We can't trust them. And you know as well as I how true that is in our backgrounds, where there can be a suspicion and animosity toward a group because we don't know them. And the best way to keep that sort of thing going is by not getting to know them. If the king had asked, who are they? And Haman had said, well, they're the Jews. It may be that the king might have said, wait a minute. I remember a Jew who discovered an assassination plot for me. It might have come to his mind, but he just trusted Haman. And if you have a hatred for any group, or you have a distrust of any group, or you have a tendency to look at any certain group of people and to think, I don't think we can trust them. I don't want to get too close to them. That's the way to keep that prejudice going. Refuse to get to know them. Today, just to be very practical, I think probably one of the toughest groups that we have to deal with prejudices toward has nothing to do with skin color. It has everything to do with religious views. I think would be Islam, Muslims throughout the world. Would you say it's true probably in North America? And after all, we can point to how Muslims, you know, attacked our country and did various things. But we have to understand, there are Muslims and there are Muslims. And to put everybody in the same category is a dangerous thing. And it might do us well to ask, have I ever met a Muslim? Have I gotten to know any Muslims? Because even though they may not know Jesus as their Savior, they're those whom Christ died for. And we don't want to write them all off as Haman did with the Jews, saying, get rid of them all, they're all our problem. But that's the way prejudice works. It sees a problem and it says, they're all bad. Get rid of them all. And that's what Haman wanted to do with the Jews here. He depersonalized them. And after all, Xerxes, he had survived Vashti's rebellion. Remember in chapter 1, his wife who wouldn't obey him. And then history tells us Xerxes had just come through two failed Greek war campaigns. famous battle, the Battle of Salamis, where the Greek navy had defeated the Persian navy under Xerxes, and he had lost that, and he had survived an assassination plot against him. Well, he certainly didn't want another rebellion, and if his second hand in charge, Haman, is telling him, you can't trust these people, okay, Haman. You know, he just listens to them. And Haman goes on in verse 9. He adds to the pot here. Notice verse 9. He said, if it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I'll give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. Now notice how wise and shrewd Haman is. If it pleases the king. He doesn't say, king, you got to kill these people. He's not that foolish. King, whatever you think is best, if it pleases you, I mean, you can't trust them. They keep themselves separate. They break all kinds of laws, and you know, they're no good. So if it pleases you, and besides that, I'll sweeten the pot here. I'll give 10,000 talents of silver toward the royal treasury just to make sure this gets carried out. Now, that is a huge amount of wealth. Haman was a wealthy guy, and we don't know how he got his wealth. In fact, the Greek historian Herodotus tells us that the whole revenue of the Persian Empire for 1 year was 15,000 talents. And here Haman offers 10,000 talents? It was a massive amount of wealth. Now, why would he do this? Because Haman so hated the Jews. And besides that, he realized if he could kill all the Jews, he could probably restore all his wealth pretty quickly with taking from them. That's exactly what happened during World War II when Jews were exterminated, 6 million Jews killed during the Holocaust, and their wealth was confiscated and taken. And in fact, some of you may remember the German government tried to restore some of that in an act of contrition here a few years back. But literally, he was willing to weigh out on the hands of the doers of this business. That's literally what it says. He was willing to pay to get this done. Now, let me just say, if this seems far-fetched, genocide, in our generation, in our lifetime, for many of us in our lifetime, we have seen genocide after genocide. Those of you who were around during World War II, of course, are familiar with the events there, the genocide that took place of the Jews there. But in various other spots, genocides, for the last 25, 30 years, one of the mass genocides of our generation has taken place in southern Sudan, where literally a couple million people have been killed, and it's absolutely phenomenal. And the genocide that took place in Cambodia during the Pol Pot regime, some of you remember the name Idi Amin in Uganda, in Korea, in various other places, groups have been singled out to be exterminated. It is not uncommon in our world, but we can ask, how does evil get to that point? How does evil, we can easily just say, it's no big deal. It's not happening here in the United States. No big deal. Evil is far more than just a group of people. And our tendency is to look at evil, mass evil like that, and say, that's their problem, and we don't want that here. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a Russian dissident who came to the United States back in the 70s, and just died a few years ago, but a brilliant man, made an important observation, a number of important observations, but one, as he was in a Soviet prison for a number of years before he came to the United States, made this statement. He said, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But, he said, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? That's the problem. You see, we can't just say, they're evil, and that's the root of our problem, let's get rid of them. But that's the way humanity works. That's how you get genocides going on. And this morning, even though we don't have a genocide here in the United States, can you think of any peoples that you look at and say, if we could just get rid of that group, it'd be a smooth sailing, it'd be a piece of cake. Get rid of those Muslims, we wouldn't have these problems. Get rid of those Democrats, get rid of those Republicans, we wouldn't have these problems. We tend to put people in groups and say, that's the truth of the matter is, evil runs right straight through my heart and your heart. And what we're battling is not people. What we're battling is sin and the father of lies, Satan himself. And when we look at this situation here, what we see here is the great mistake of humanity in Haman as he tries to destroy a group that he thought was evil. What do we learn from this, from Haman? The negative example he gives us? Well, first of all, don't plan evil. When I sense in my heart evil welling up, bitterness, hatred, revenge, whether toward a group of people or toward an individual, the natural thing, the thing I want to do, is to feed that desire for revenge and feed that bitterness. And that's what Haman did. And when you feed it, you look for approval and you seek to justify it and you begin to talk to others about it and you look for their agreement with you. And that's what Haman did. But if we want to defeat evil, when we see it coming in our lives, we've got to admit it for what it is and say, God, forgive me. Lord, I don't have the power to get rid of this. Lord, will you change my heart? Will you replace evil with your truth and with love and your righteousness? Now, that doesn't mean that we don't hate evil. We hate evil, but we don't hate people. And that was the mistake of Haman here. Instead, when we feel evil, or what Haman did here, is he fed it. He justified it. And he began to plan based upon his evil desires. And when we hang on to it, refusing to let it go or turn from it, we progress on to the next stage of evil, looking for those who approve our evil and help to authorize it. And that's what we see take place there in verses 10 and 11. Verse 10, so the king took his signet ring from his finger, and he gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Now notice, King Xerxes takes off his ring. What was the significance of that ring? Well, basically it was saying, here, Haman, you've got my authority. I'm giving you my ring. It's interesting how rings worked. When they would enact a law, they would write that law, they'd roll it up in a scroll, and they'd seal it with a wax seal. And then, while the wax was still fresh, they'd press it with the king's ring. The king would put his imprint on it, and that said, this law is by authority of the king. And here the king is giving his ring to Haman. So he's saying, Haman, whatever you want to do, here it is. Here's my ring. He gives that authority to him. Now, it's interesting again here in verse 10 that we are given the full name of Haman. Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Remember when we talked about Haman a couple of weeks ago, the background to Haman? Agagite. It's very possible that he was a descendant of King Agag, mentioned earlier, who was during the reign of King Saul in Israel. King Agag was an Amalekite, and the Amalekites for centuries before that had been enemies of the Jews. And God had told King Saul, destroy the Amalekites, and Saul had refused to do that, and they had survived and continue to be at odds with Israel. And now here we have Haman, the Agagite, seeking to destroy the Jews. And notice that final phrase in verse 10, he's referred to as the enemy of the Jews. Haman had kept secret the identity of the group that he wished to exterminate, but he was an enemy of the Jews. And if we look through history, we see many enemies of the Jews. The Assyrian Empire persecuted the Jews. The Babylonians persecuted the Jews. Now the Persians persecute. Even the Roman Empire kicked all the Jews out of Rome. We read about that in the New Testament book of Acts. And the Spanish Inquisition aimed at evangelical Christians or Bible-believing Christians, but also aimed at the Jews. And then, of course, World War II, Hitler. Throughout history, anti-Semitism has been rife, and it continues to grow in our world. There is a growing anti-Semitism throughout Asia that is very, very concerning. In fact, I was reading this last week here, threats from an official in Iran just concerning their whole nuclear missile program, and bringing up Israel as a possible recipient of that. So when we read about this, it's nothing new. It's an ancient thing, and the king gave free rein. Here's my ring. You go ahead, Haman. Do what you want. In fact, look at his words in verse 11. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. Now, in actuality, many Bible scholars believe that when the king said, keep your money, that he was just using a Mideastern politeness, that he really expected Haman to follow through and give the money to it. But He did give authority to Haman, do with them as you please. Now let me ask you a moment here. It's hard to imagine this situation because we have never grown up with this. Have you ever woken up a day in your life here in this United States for fear that someone was going to come after you to kill you because you were on a target list? Probably not, especially as a group. But can you imagine getting up in the morning, turning on the TV news, turning on Fox News or CNN News or NBC, ABC, CBS, only to hear an anchorman announce a new and unchangeable law making Christianity illegal and lethal? Can you imagine what that would be like? A new law just enacted by Congress, signed by the president, put into law, is now saying Christianity is not to be practiced, and 11 months from now, all Christians will be killed. You may leave the country or be murdered. Now, suppose, like most of the people in Persia, the borders to the kingdom were so distant, there's no way you could get out of the country in those 11 months. You know what's interesting, and I've neglected to mention it, back in verse 7, when the lot was chosen and it fell on the 12th month, there were 11 months before that event would be carried out, that the Jews would be killed. That would give them time to do something. God, in his sovereign control, gave them 11 months with which to prepare for this. But can you imagine when the word would come out on that, what that would be like? How can a kingdom get to that place where suddenly it wants to kill a whole group of people? And this has happened repeatedly throughout history. Maybe some of you remember a few years back, actually probably 20, 25 or 30 years now, in Africa, the two tribes, the Hutus and the Tutsis, that were fighting back and forth. A huge genocide took place there. People killed by the hundreds and thousands. Absolutely. I mean, how does that happen? Today, those two groups are living together and they're getting along. They have their differences, but they're getting along. How does it happen? How does it happen? It happens through pride, through hatred, and through prejudice. And it can happen again in this United States, even though we aren't used to it. In our lifetimes, we've been spared from this. When evil is authorized or approved, it can grow rapidly. And that's what would happen here. So just a couple lessons about evil in my own heart, in my own life, for each of us. What this says to us by example is don't enable evil. Either in your own heart or around you. And when you see evil, don't smile at it, don't encourage it, don't enable it. When you see that which is wrong, when you see someone being mistreated wrongly, don't ignore it and be apathetic toward it. All it takes, someone said, for evil to win is for good men to do nothing. Well, where does it go from there? Evil was planned and entreated and it was enabled. Where does it go? In verse 12, we see it enlarged. We read these words, "Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned, and they wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all of Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring." Now I want us to note the timing on this here. On the 13th day of the first month, this new decree that all Jews are to be killed on the 13th day, 11 months from now. As you look at that date, the 13th day of the first month, does that ring a bell? Probably not for most of us. The book of Exodus, when the Jews were being brought out of Egypt and God set up the Passover, that took place on the 14th day of the first month. At this time that this decree was being made, the Jews in Persia were preparing to celebrate the Passover. In fact, this decree was made on the 13th, and it went out probably and began to arrive and be proclaimed on the 14th. You know what took place in the Jewish Passover on the 14th day of that first month of Nisan? Every Jewish home was to gather together and to take a Passover lamb, and they were to kill that Passover lamb, and they were to celebrate the Passover meal. And do you remember what that meant? How in Egypt God had told them, when you kill that Passover lamb, you put the blood on the doorposts and God will not slay your firstborn. The angel of death will pass over your house. And by doing this, God would free you from Egypt, because only the Jewish firstborn would live. And Pharaoh would say, "Get out of here." And remember, God sent his people out of Egypt by that Passover. And every year after that, the Jews were to reenact the Passover meal, reminding them of how God delivers them and how he delivered them in Egypt. And now here on the 13th and then over into the 14th, they're hearing a decree come down from King Xerxes of Persia that every Jew is to be killed. Do you think that timing is just coincidental? Probably not. Probably had something to do with God saying to the people, I delivered you back then, I can deliver you now. I am your salvation, not King Xerxes. I like what Bible teacher Beth Moore has to say about that. Sometimes God uses the winds of a new threat to blow the dust off of a past miracle that has moved from our active file into the archives. But remember what God has done for you. Rehearse the story. If God saved you from Egypt, can't he save you from the Persians? And I'll tell you, we need that in our lives too. If God has done something in your life, releasing you from some bondage, can't he also take care of the problem that you face today? If God worked in your life in the past, can't he do it again? If God has delivered you from drugs, can't he deliver you now from despair? If he's delivered you from booze, can't he deliver you from binge eating? What he's saying to the Jews is, in this time frame, is, remember, I am the God of deliverance. And you don't need to fear in the midst of this. And notice from verse 12 there, that decree was drawn up into each language. Do you realize that it's estimated that in this vast empire from India all the way through Turkey and down into North Africa, that there were as many as 127 different languages plus different dialects? That was a massive translation job that he had everybody working on. And then it was sealed with the king's ring, given the king's authority, and it was sent out. This whole situation here reminds us that even though there was a mass genocide now being announced, God was still in charge. In verse 13, we read, dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, to plunder their goods. And a copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. This law probably went out by horseback riders, couriers. It was like the Persian Pony Express. Send it out. Get it out as quick as possible. We want people to be able to prepare. 11 months from now, the 13th day of that last month of the year, it is going to be open season on the Jews. And we want everybody involved. And notice what we're going to do to them. Destroy, kill, and annihilate. Those three words put together to emphasize it is complete. And as you look at that, he lists, now many times men were just representative of the whole society, but he mentions not just Jews generally, he says young and old, women and children on a single day. This is going to be complete. Kill the Jew day. Why? How did this start? It started from one guy full of hatred, getting others on board with him, and the ball gets rolling. You say, well, that can't happen. But it does happen around the world repeatedly. Genocides and hatred. And here in the United States, it hasn't taken the form of genocide. It's taken the form of hatred between various races or hatred between classes or suspicions. And what we see here is, in this situation, evil dispatched to carry out this wicked decree. Now, thankfully, God is sovereign, and they still had 11 months before this would be carried out. But anti-Semitism is no new thing. It's been around for years. J. Vernon McGee, an old Bible teacher, said it well. He said, the Jew has attended the funeral of every one of the nations that ever tried to exterminate him. And Haman would be no exception to that. And we'll read about that in the weeks to come. But notice the response there in the city of Susa, verse 15, these words. The couriers went out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. That city of Susa, where this took place, is still in existence today, although it's changed, and there's a vast archaeological ruins there of the ancient city of Susa. I mentioned a few weeks ago, this ancient city, this citadel, this royal palace area, sits atop a large hill area, plateau, and that's where the king had all of his court and everything there. And just a couple of weeks ago, when we were visiting David out east for his graduation, we were with David and two of his good friends this last year out in Boston. One of them is from Mexico, a doctor from Mexico, and the other is a doctor from Iran. His name is Kavi, and Kavi is an atheist. David and Luis, his other friend, have been reaching out to him to share the love of Christ with him. But I was talking with Kavi about this. I said, Kavi, we're starting to read in the book of Esther about Susa, and that's in your home country there. Have you ever been there? He said, oh, yeah. He said, I've been there. He said, we don't call it Susa, though. We call it Shush. So you might see it referred to sometimes in Scripture, even as Shushan. And he said, that's the title of it. So when we're talking about these events, understand, this is not made-up stuff. This is time and space. These events actually occurred. And there's a huge lesson about evil here. And you notice that as this order went out, you had two responses here. The response of Haman and the king was to sit down and eat and drink like nothing was going on. It's business as usual. How is it that people can take lightly destruction of other lives? How does that happen? And then the response of the city of Susa, bewilderment. Why? Why? Now, I want to make just a couple of comments here quickly. We have never been in our United States as a body of Christ put in a position where we have to choose whether we are going to obey God or we are going to sin against God by obeying what our government tells us to do. Our government has enacted in times some laws that allow us to sin, but they don't force us to sin until perhaps recently. I read an interesting comment by James Dobson here regarding the health care plan, and his statement here was a concern for the Catholic Church being forced to support through the insurance company to provide abortion services and contraception in direct violation of their conscience. And James Dobson made this statement. I thought it was very interesting. And again, this has nothing to do with Republican, Democrat. It has to do with what do we do if our government would come to the place where it would tell us we have to do something that goes clearly against our conscience. Here's what James Dobson said. He said, I want to be very careful regarding what I'm about to write now. It will not be said flippantly or with malice, but it will reflect the passion of my heart. I believe in the rule of law, and it's been my practice since I was in college to respect and honor those in authority over us. It is my desire to do so now. However, this assault on the sanctity of human life takes me where I cannot go. I will not pay the surcharge for abortion services. The amount of the surcharge is irrelevant. To pay 1 cent for the killing of babies is egregious to me, and I will do all I can to correct a government that lies to me about its intentions and then tries to coerce my acquiescence with extortion. And he says it would be a violation of my most deeply held convictions to disobey what I consider to be the principles of Scripture. The Creator will not hold us guiltless if we turn a deaf ear to the cries of innocent babies. So come and get me if you must, but I will not bow before a wicked regulation. The issue of how we deal with laws that counter God's will vary within the body of Christ. And this is one of the situations that the church has faced through the centuries. When a ruler says, do this, and one Christian says, I cannot according to conscience, and another Christian says, well, I can do that, but I can't do this, and we stand in different spots, it's very easy for division to come within the body of Christ, and we must not let that happen. Unless there's spiritual revival in our land and there is a vast turning in our land, and God alone knows that, but unless that happens, the days will get more and more difficult, and our government, whoever wins elections, our government eventually, our society will demand that Christians cross lines at certain points. May that not divide the body of Christ, but also may we not neglect our conscience. May we be faithful to what God calls us to do also. May we not be apathetic about evil. May we not begin to hate those who hang on to evil. That's what Haman thought. I can get rid of the Jews and my problem will be gone. But the problem in our country and in our world is not a certain political party, and it's not a certain race. The problem is the evil of my heart. So we've got to see the enemy for who it really is, and we've got to hate evil, and we've got to love people for whom Jesus Christ died. So apathy in the face of evil is always, always wrong. The wrong answer. Bob Pierce, founder of World Vision, was an American evangelist and war correspondent who traveled to China with Youth for Christ in 1947. And when he was there, he saw the plight of kids in China. And his heart broke in particular for one little girl, and he pledged, "I'm going to send a monthly amount to a local missionary to ensure her care." And that planted the seeds for World Vision's future child sponsorship model that now many organizations like Compassion and various others have followed. But Bob Pierce was traveling in the Mideast there, and he visited suffering children on the Korean island of Kokjido. And after being there, he wrote in the flyleaf of his Bible these words, "Let my heart be broken with the things that break the heart of God." And that heart attitude became the foundation for World Vision, that was then founded in 1950, and Samaritan's Purse later founded in 1970. But the question I read, or I thought of when I read those words, is, what does it take to break my heart? What evil does it take to break my heart? To knock me off a chair of apathy and to say, "I'm going to do something about this. I can't do everything. None of us can do everything, but I'm going to do something about this." Because it's so easy to become apathetic with evil all around us and evil in our own hearts, and we dare not. The story is told of a farmer in a Midwestern state that had a strong disdain for religious things. He didn't like Christians, and as he plowed his field one Sunday morning, he shook his fist at people heading to church, passing by on their way to worship. October came, and the farmer had the finest crop ever and the best in the county, and when it was complete, he placed an ad in the local paper that belittled Christians for their faith in God. And near the end of his article that he put in the paper, he wrote, "Faith in God must not mean much if someone like me can prosper." We might be tended to, think that, you know, if a guy like Haman can get ahead, faith in God must not mean much. If the wicked can prosper, faith must not mean much. God must not be on the throne. Something's not right. But the Christians of the community answered quietly and politely in the next edition of the town paper with a small ad that simply read this: God doesn't always settle his accounts in October. He doesn't. Evil is evil. And we've got to see it for what it is. And when we see it in ourselves, we've got to say, "Oh God, forgive me. Root it out. Give me a love for people as you love people. Help me see people as you see people, but never help me love evil or be apathetic with evil. Help me hate evil because it destroys people."